Hey, Brooklyn Nine-Niners. It's a reunion. The ladies of the Nine-Nine are getting back together for a special episode of the podcast, More Better. Hosts Stephanie Beatriz and Melissa Fumero welcome friend and former castmate Chelsea Peretti.
Remember when we were in that scene where you guys were just supposed to hug and I was standing there?
Oh, yeah.
I was like, can I also hug them?
Listen to More Better with Stephanie and Melissa on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Follow More Better and start listening on the free iHeart Radio app today.
Black History Month is here, and we're excited to kick off season 4 of I Didn't Know, Maybe You Didn't Either. This season, we're shining a spotlight on revolutionary women who redefined excellence. Give Grace Wisher her flowers. Next time you see the American flag, you just remember a 16-year-old black woman helped to make it happen. Listen to I Didn't Know, Maybe You Didn't Either from the Black Effect Podcast Network on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcast, or simply wherever you get your podcasts.
What if you asked two different people the same set of questions? Even if the questions are the same, our experiences can lead us to drastically different answers. I'm Minnie Driver, and I set out to explore this idea in my podcast, and now Minnie Questions is returning for another season. We've asked an entirely new set of guests our 7 questions, including Jane Lynch, Delaney Rowe, and Cord Jefferson. Listen to Minnie Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
Just after 4 a.m. on November 16, 1979, in front of a Boston housing project, some neighbors heard a commotion and saw a group of 3 men from a distance rob and fatally shoot a cab driver. Another cab driver came forward and claimed to have witnessed the very moment when the assailants first hailed the cab in downtown Boston. And after hypnosis, the cabbie identified 16-year-old Fred Clay and 20-year-old James Watson as 2 of the 3 assailants. Then the witnesses from the scene agreed, resulting in the 2 young men being sent away for life. This is Wrongful Conviction. You're listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction, where we're going to go back to Boston for the 1979 robbery and murder of a taxi driver, when both public and private pressure produced some very dubious witnesses, and 2 young men were sacrificed to alleviate that pressure. Let's call it what it is. We originally covered this story back in 2019 with Fred Clay, the co-defendant of our guest today, Mr. James Watson. James, thanks for joining us.
Yes, no problem.
And with him is his appellate attorney, Barb Monroe. Barb, thanks for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
Now, James, you grew up in Boston, right?
I've been in Boston all my life, born and raised with my mother and my 2 brothers and 2 sisters. My father, he did not stay with us, but there was another man that did live with us, which is my baby sister's father, Joe. And he drank a lot, and he picked fights with my mother. And one day he slapped my mother in the mouth, and I had to be around 9 or 10. I lost it, and I went to the kitchen, and I got every can I can possibly get out the cabinet and use it to throw them at him, and I lost the fight. But he had bruises. He had bruises. So we moved from Blue Hill Ave to Orchard Park to get away from him, and he found us. And the guy came in and knocked on the door. I ain't seen him in a long time, so I actually really didn't recognize him. But he knocked on the door, and my mother opened the door, and I heard her say, "How did you find me?" And he said, "I want to see my daughter." And my mother said, you don't supposed to be here." That's when I realized that's Joe. That's the bastard. You know, I'm much older now. You know, I was about 15, 16. And I've told my buddy, I said, "Let's kick his ass." You know what I mean? Let's whoop his ass. But my sister, she was young. She said, "I want to see my daddy." So that's what stopped me from whooping his ass.
The family moved again, this time to the Archdale housing projects in Roslindale. And over the next few years, James's photo ended up in the system for a petty theft. And he also met his son's mother, Diane Moses.
I met Diane in 1970, 7. We was only together for like 2 years before all this happened. She had 2 kids already, a boy and a girl. And then she got pregnant with my son, Don Juan Moses. He was 13 months at the time before this crime happened. I was on top of the world when he was born. I was so full of joy and happiness to have a son. Everybody loved him, especially the women. The girl loved him.
And this brings us to the fateful night of November 16th, 1979, just a little after 4 a.m., when a 28-year-old cab driver named Jeffrey Boyajian was dropping off a fare at the Archdale Housing Projects, and 25-year-old neighbor Neil Sweat described what he saw from his window.
A cab shows up, and it's dark. It's about at least 80 feet from where the cab is to where this young man is looking out the window. And he sees a cab driver getting pulled out of the cab, and he sees 3 black men. 2 was tall, 1 was small, and then he sees the shorter one shoot the cab driver 5 times. And then they took off. He had called another person who was there to go to work with him to come look out the window as well.
And the other young man was named Ben Brown.
Ben Brown, he used to pick Sweat up to go to work, because Sweat couldn't read the signs on the bus. And they get on the bus together and ride up to Rosendale Square. The whole family couldn't read or write. The mother couldn't read or write.
This young man who witnessed this had some severe intellectual disabilities. And his mother was also there, and she looked out and she saw whatever she saw. And she also had severe intellectual disabilities as well.
And the mother's name was Philippa Sweat. And being 80 feet away with the aid of only 1 streetlight, the Sweats were only confident that the assailants wore leather jackets. The 2 were tall and 1 was small, but they weren't confident in their ability to identify them. Meanwhile, the police continued their canvas.
I was home asleep, and the detectives came and knocked on my door and asked, did I hear anything or did I see anything? I said, no, I was 4 in the morning. No, I was in La La Land. I was asleep. I did not hear anything.
James had a 13-month-old son, so it's more likely that he'd be getting every minute of sleep that he could rather than staying out till 4 a.m. and committing a robbery and murder with 2 other guys, one of whom, Fred Clay, he only knew through his would-be mother-in-law.
His mother used to hang out with Diane's mother, and that's how I knew Freddie. But I never hung out with this kid. He wasn't even 16.
Plus, Freddie lived at a foster home, not at the projects, and perhaps both of their relationships with the system played into how they were singled out when another cab driver named Richard Dwyer came forward that Friday morning with a story which started out with some naked racism.
Supposedly, this cab driver saw 3 black men in the red light district down on Washington Street, and he put his meter on to look that he was busy. So the 3 black men get into a cab in the cab left. And then the next day is when the cab driver allegedly sees a picture in the paper of the cab that Jeffrey had been driving. And he remembers the cab as the one he saw these 3 black men get into.
But this shooting happened around 4 a.m. and that morning's newspaper had already been printed. So no, Mr. Dwyer, you didn't recognize the license number of Jeffrey Boyajian's cab in the newspaper. You couldn't have. And it's possible that Dwyer, well, he could have been motivated by some understandable fear among cab drivers and their business interests.
The day that James was arrested, there was an article in the paper as well about the cab drivers being upset that there was not enough done about the shooting. And there had been a lot of shootings. And so they were saying if it was the police getting shot, they'd be doing something. So there was a lot of pressure on the police to get this taken care of as well.
So now, as an alleged eyewitness, Dwyer met with Boston police officer Patrick Brady, who had taken a number of hypnotism courses. And at some point, Dwyer was also shown some photo arrays.
They hypnotize him and they tell him that it's like a video recording, so he can stop the frame when he sees the men who are getting into the cab. And the particular man that he focused in on was allegedly James, because he was the polite gentleman letting the other 2 in the cab. At least he was polite. And he could describe him, and he described allegedly Fred as well. Couldn't really describe the 3rd person.
I think anyone with a human brain can recognize that their memories do not work like an on-demand video streaming service with Zoom capabilities. But there's even more. The order of photo viewing and hypnotism is also very important.
This was going to be a case of first impression. whether hypnotic identifications would be admissible in Massachusetts. So they knew that if the testimony came out that he had looked at the photographs after he was hypnotized, it would be inadmissible. What they said happened was that he was shown photographs of, I think it was 16 random Black men from the projects, and he chose James and Fred. Now, allegedly, they said this happened before he was hypnotized. The reality that we find out when we did our investigation was that did not happen that way. So they had to change the narrative that he made the identification untainted by any hypnosis. So the hypnotism in itself is junk science. But the fact that the prosecutor, we believe, lied, and we found evidence in the DA files that showed that he did, is pretty problematic.
Perhaps the prospect of using hypnotic identifications going forward was just too alluring. Luckily for all of us, the precedent was not established. However, the doctored narrative was that Dwyer made a tentative ID of James and Fred from 16 photos of local Black men before being hypnotized, and then making a confident identification of both, which also raises the specter of solidifying a false memory. Either way, the police sought support for this dubious ID process.
They have took Diane down to the police station that Friday of the crime. I didn't know that. And she never told me that they pulled her over and took her down to the station. I had to find out down the road, they threatened her to give her 7 years in Framingham, take her kids from her, and cut her off public aid if you try to give your boyfriend a fucking alibi. That's what they told her.
Despite Diane naming alternate suspects who were known for similar crimes and had been wearing leather jackets, she was being coerced into implicating James. But at this time, she hadn't yet committed to helping the police.
So after that, they had me down at the station Saturday, Sunday. You know, I'm telling them, I wasn't there. I didn't do this. I got a kid, man. I did not rob no cab driver. I was not downtown 4 o'clock in the morning. Then Detective Burlow, he said, are you willing to take a polygraph test? I said, listen, man, I'll take a polygraph test, drug syrup, whatever you want me to do that make you understand that I'm telling you the truth. I didn't do this. I wouldn't do this. And he said, okay, we'll do the polygraph. 1 o'clock Monday. So he let me leave.
Meanwhile, they had been talking to Philippa and Neil Sweat.
They start interviewing the Sweats and showing them photographs. And this went on over the course of the entire weekend. Well, come to find out that the Sweats had wanted to move out of the projects for a long time because they were one of the few white families living there. And they wanted to move to the white projects. So finally, by Monday, they convinced Mr. Sweat that he could identify Mr. Watson and Mr. Clay, and he did. Fred was the gunman, and James was just there to assist. And the third person, who knows? And they moved them.
And they tried to use hypnosis with Neil Sweat as well.
They did, but because of his intellectual disabilities, his concentration, it didn't go so well.
At this time, Philippa Sweat was not willing to join her son in making an ID. Meanwhile, James still thought a polygraph would prove his innocence, but Detective Burlow didn't come to get him until late Monday evening, without his partner, but rather some mystery man who left when they arrived at the precinct and James was brought inside.
I'm sitting in the office, and it's just me, Detective Burlow, and Detective Paul Carroll. He said, what went wrong, man? You know what I mean? Why'd you kill him? This is supposed to be for a polygraph. I didn't do this. And then he said, you've been identified. I said, what? He said, you've been identified. I said, get the fuck out of here. I said, who identified me? Who? Let me see him. Who? You know, you've been identified. And you're being booked for murder. Booked me. Fingerprint me. Took me to Charles Street Jail. And that's where I remained for 23 months.
This episode of Wrongful Conviction is proudly sponsored by Erase PTSD Now. Every day, countless individuals face the invisible wounds of trauma and PTSD. Your support empowers us to provide life-changing treatments like the stellate ganglion block, SGB, which inhibits nerve impulses and helps to restore hope, reclaim lives, and save lives after incarceration. Together, we can ensure that those wrongfully convicted receive the care they need to heal and reintegrate into society. Join us in this mission to erase PTSD and uplift our communities. Visit erasePTSDnow.org. That's erasePTSDnow.org for more information and ways to get involved.
The more better, the merrier. Title of your podcast. All your old Brooklyn Nine-Nine friends are appearing on your favorite podcast, More Better. Don't miss Brooklyn Nine-Nine stars and show hosts Stephanie Beatriz and Melissa Fumero as they welcome their friends and former castmates back to laugh about old times and swap some stories. This week, it's Gina Linetti herself, the talented Chelsea Peretti.
Remember when we were in that scene where you guys were just supposed to hug and I was standing there?
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, can I also hug them?
Then next week, the 9-9 nonsense continues as the More Better amigas sit down with Joe Latrulio, a.k.a. Detective Charles Boyle. There'll be more laughs, more conversation, more stories from the set, and more better. Don't miss a minute.
You felt safe enough to throw out a bad idea, right? I mean, that is the key, because you're definitely not throwing out good ideas all the time. I mean, that's just not how it works.
Listen to More Better with Stephanie and Melissa on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Mark Seal.
And I'm Nathan King.
This is Leave the Gun, Take the Cannoli.
The five families did not want us to shoot that picture.
Leave the Gun, Take the Cannoli is based on my co-host Mark's best-selling book of the same title. And on this show, we call upon his years of research to help unpack the story behind the Godfather's birth from start to finish.
This is really the first interview I've done in bed.
We sift through innumerable accounts.
35 pages isn't very much.
Many of them conflicting.
That's nonsense. There were 60 pages.
And try to get to the truth of what really happened.
And they said, we're finished. This is over. Not only is that going to work, you got to get rid of those guys. It's a disaster.
Leave the Gun, Take the Cannoli features new and archival interviews with Francis Ford Coppola, Robert Evans, James Caan, Talia Shire, and many others.
Yes, that was a real horse's head.
Listen and subscribe to Leave the Gun, Take the Cannoli on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yo, what up? It's your girl, Jess Hilarious, and I think it's time to acknowledge that I'm not just a comedian. It's time to add uncertified therapist to my credentials, because each and every Wednesday, I'm fixing your mess on Carefully Reckless on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Got problems in your relationship? Come to me. Your best friend acting shady? Come to me. Thinking about cursing that one stank auntie out at the next family gathering? Do it. But come to me before you do, because I cussed all mine out before. You want to fight your coworkers? Come to me. Baby daddy mad because you got a boyfriend? Come to me. Thought you was the father, but you not? Come to me. I can't promise I won't judge you, but I can guarantee that I will help you. As a daughter, a sister, a mother, and an entrepreneur, I've learned a lot in life. So I'm using my own perspective and experiences to help you fix your mess. Send me your situation, and let's fix it as a family. Listen to Carefully Reckless on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Freddie, they made him my co-defendant, which I didn't know of. I happened to be in Child Street playing cards. He came to Child Street. And I said, damn, Freddie, what'd they get you for? Oh, I'm in here for the same thing you are. I said, what? He said, yeah, they say I shot the guy. I said, oh, shit. Later on, they came and they pulled him out of Child Street. And then the lawyer came up. He said, look, they don't want you, right? They want Freddie. You know what I mean? They want the shooter. If you testify against Freddie, the DA said he'll give you time served and cut you loose. But all you have to do is testify against Frederick Clay.
Who was a 16-year-old child at that time?
Yeah, was a baby. He was a kid. He was locked up in a foster home. Under lock and key. The woman's name was Mrs. King. She lived in a foster home. Where the only way you can get out the house is use a key to open the door from the inside.
And if you'd like to hear Fred's side of this story, and I hope you will, we're going to link his interview in the episode description. So anyway, neither of them took a deal. Oddly, they didn't apply more pressure on James, considering the options, time served or death.
I didn't know about the death penalty statute until I went for my arraignment. And Timothy O'Neill, I'll never forget that bastard. He asked Judge Irwin, I can never forget that as long as I live. He said, I'd like to indict Mr. Watson under the death penalty status, Your Honor, due to the nature of the crime and the underlying felony, the robbery. And Judge Irwin put his glasses down over his big fucking nose and said, granted. I said, death penalty? What the? Now I'm scared. I'm shook. You know what I mean? I'm growing gray hairs at a very early age.
10 months. 10 months he sat in jail knowing that he was facing the death penalty until they took it to court. And then with a case that bears his name and three others, they found that the death penalty was unconstitutional.
Yeah, this is one of those cases that abolished the death penalty in Massachusetts. But not knowing this outcome, James still didn't waver. It's amazing. Unfortunately, Diane Moses had her children to think of, so she agreed to help the police.
I found that out when I'm sitting in Charles Street, and then Frank Kelleher, attorney, came up, said, Diane, your girlfriend, Moses, is going to testify against you, saying that you told her you was there, but you didn't do the shooting. I said, what? I never told her that. Well, that's what she's going to testify to. And if you want to, I ain't changing shit. I did not do this. I did not kill nobody. I would never kill nobody or let nobody be killed. But anyway, I had to find out down the road, they threatened her. I'm saying, wow, they must have really did a job on her. So I'm missing my son. And I told my sister, I said, Joanne, go down over there, get my son and bring him up here to visit me. So she goes down to the apartment. The apartment is empty. They took her and moved her down south.
You mean like South Boston?
Georgia.
Georgia.
And that's where she stayed until trial. Now, even though Fred was the alleged shooter, both Fred and James were charged with first-degree murder, which later became an issue that won James a new trial. But either way, the first trial proceeded in August of 1981.
Fred and James were tried together, and there was no physical evidence. And Neil Sweat identified them with his magical powers of sight. And Richard Dwyer came in and identified both of them. And so he had everyone believing that they had made this initial identification free of hypnotism.
And then he spoke about how his hypnotism session was like watching a movie of the assailants getting into Jeffrey Boyajian's cab.
Yes, you say it was like being at the movie, you know what I mean? He can picture it clearly that, yes, this is the guy I saw. He said, we walked diagonal across the street. I opened the door, let the other two get in, and then I walked around, looked him in the face, and then got into the car, and the cab drove off.
Then Boston police officer Patrick Brady was sworn in as an expert investigative hypnologist. Okay? And he testified that the mind can take mental pictures that are encoded in the brain. I'm pausing here because I'm losing my shit. Okay, deep breath. Then the state also presented an LAPD psychologist, a guy named Martin Reiser, who testified that the mind works like a giant computerized videotape recording. I mean, fuck off with this shit. And anyway, the defense presented their own expert, a doctor named Martin Orne, who said that this tape recorder theory of human memory has no scientific support because, of course, it doesn't. And then the state called Ben Brown.
Ben Brown didn't testify against me.
He testified at the first trial, and he was technically an adverse witness for the Commonwealth. He did say he saw two people pull the cab driver out, but he didn't recognize the shooter. And he testified that it was not James, that he didn't see him out there.
So Fred and James both testified in their own defense, saying that they'd had nothing to do with the shooting. But then Diane Moses took the stand.
She said, I told her that I was there and that he didn't do the shooting. And she said this. He said, we are not going to tell the police anything else. I said, we? Who the hell are you talking about? We. She was implicating herself. That's how scared she was. You know, because to find out, they kept harassing her every time they saw her.
So the trial wrapped up with two alleged eyewitness IDs, opposing expert testimony on hypnosis, followed by Diane Moses with this alleged confession.
They came back with a question. The jury said, Judge, can you define first-degree murder? The judge said, you read the evidence. You got the record. Go on back in there and deliberate with it. So he wouldn't answer their question. And they went back there and came back guilty. Guilty of first-degree murder. And the judge said, I'm sending you to your natural life in state penitentiary. That was it.
The more better, the merrier. Title of your podcast. All your old Brooklyn Nine-Nine friends are appearing on your favorite podcast, More Better. Don't miss Brooklyn Nine-Nine stars and show hosts Stephanie Beatriz and Melissa Fumero as they welcome their friends and former castmates back to laugh about old times and swap some stories. This week, it's Gina Linetti herself, the talented Chelsea Peretti.
Remember when we were in that scene where you guys were just supposed to hug and I was standing there?
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, can I also hug them?
Then next week, the 9-9 nonsense continues as the More Better Amigas sit down with Joe Latrullio, a.k.a. Detective Charles Foyle. There'll be more laughs, more conversation, more stories from the set, and more better. Don't miss a minute.
You felt safe enough to throw out a bad idea, right? I mean, that is the key, because you're definitely not throwing out good ideas all the time. I mean, that's just not how it works.
Listen to More Better with Stephanie and Melissa on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome. My name is Paola Pedrosa, a medium and the host of the Ghost Therapy podcast, where it's not just about connecting with deceased loved ones. It's about learning through them and their new perspective. Join me on the Ghost Therapy podcast.
Whoa, my lights in my living room just flickered.
I'm a little nervous. I'm excited, nervous. You know, I'm a very spiritual person, so I'm like, I'm ready and open.
That was amazing. I feel so grateful right now. I got to speak to my great-grandmother, Abuela, and she gave me a lot of really good advice that I'm going to have to really think about.
Wow, okay. That's crazy. Yes, that is accurate.
Listen to the Ghost Therapy podcast as part of the My Cultura podcast network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yo, what up? It's your girl, Jess Hilarious, and I think it's time to acknowledge that I'm not just a comedian. It's time to add uncertified therapists to my credentials, because each and every Wednesday, I'm fixing your mess on Carefully Reckless on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Got problems in your relationship? Come to me. Your best friend acting shady? Come to me. Thinking about cursing that one stank auntie out at the next family gathering? Do it. But come to me before you do, because I cussed all mine out before. You want to fight your coworkers? Come to me. Baby daddy mad because you got a boyfriend? Come to me. Thought you was the father, but you not? Come to me. I can't promise I won't judge you, but I can guarantee that I will help you. As a daughter, a sister, a mother, and an entrepreneur, I've learned a lot in life. So I'm using my own perspective and experiences to help you fix your mess. Send me your situation and let's fix it as a family. Listen to Carefully Reckless on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
After I found me guilty, they shipped me back to Child Street because they didn't have no room in Walpole. The beds were full. So I stayed in Child Street, and after the next night, they shipped me off to Walpole about 6:30 at night. And I ended up sleeping in the day room on a cot. The cot had to be about 4 feet, 5 feet, and I'm 6'6". And the next day, we went out, got up, stand up account, and get up and went for breakfast. And when I went to the chow hall, a lot of people recognized me because there's some of the guys in there were older guys, which you call OGs. You know, knew my dad. Some knew my uncle. They schooled me on what was going down. You know what I mean? You have any problems, you let us know. Don't hang with that group. Don't sit at that table. You know, you might have to get your throat cut. Sit with us. It was crazy. I was only weighing 170 pounds. I was scared to death. I ain't gonna bullshit you. You know, man, because I heard all the rumors about Walpole, you know, finding bodies 2 days later and they was raping guys. And, you know, man, I said, damn, man, I got to get through this. I didn't know if I was going to get through it or not. I wasn't contemplating on killing myself, but I said, damn, I'm going to have to learn how to be a fighting motherfucker.
And fight he did. And we don't see this often, but he actually won on direct appeal way back in March 1983. Now, the jury should have been instructed that James could be found guilty of felony murder based on robbery only if there was proof that he knew Fred had a gun. But obviously, this is only a technical issue. Fred never had a gun and didn't commit this murder, which is where it all becomes like some weird Kafka nightmare. But this is how they were able to win James a new trial, which began in January 1984. Now, the hypnosis evidence was not included. It was excluded, but the state added Philippa Sweat as a witness, who up until this point, well, she had never made an ID.
When Philippa Sweat got on the stand and was asked, do you see the defendant that you saw on November 16th, 1979, outside your window, robbing this cab driver? And she said, and the DA got so frustrated, he said, I'm going to ask you again, Mrs. Sweat. Now, remind you, each time he said this to her, right, he walked from the witness stand around the table and went directly and stood behind my chair and asked her the question again. Do you see the defendant in this courtroom that was the participant in the murder and robbery? And she said, well, and he didn't even let her finish. Do you see the defendant that you saw on November 16th? Well, to say, to tell you the truth, it was dark to say that it was him. And then I said, damn, look like I might be going home. You know what I mean? But he stood behind my chair and I looked at my lawyer. I said, like, I'm saying in my head, like, motherfucker, you going to say something? Because he's directing his witness right to me.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, it was kind of dark. So I'm saying, yeah, okay. And then finally, she says, I think that's him right there. I said, ain't this, after all that, you know what I mean? Come on. And nobody said nothing. My lawyer didn't say nothing. Then he finally stood around and said, Your Honor, he's directing the witness to the defendant. You know, he stood by. Yeah, I said, man, it's kind of late for that now.
James's attorney set up the jury thinking that Philippa Sweat is going to get up on that stand and say to you, she can't identify who, if it was him. And then she gets up on the stand and says, yeah, that was him. So that kind of sealed the deal. I mean, there was enough there already anyways, but that sealed the deal.
It was too much fabricated evidence to a lay juror. They know nothing of mistaken identifications. Eyewitness identification is the worst identification, especially a black man identifying a white person or a white person identifying a black person, that identification can be totally whack.
Yeah, cross-racial identification has been proven to be less accurate than guessing. And not even to mention that they were being incentivized 18 ways till Sunday, which gave them a lot of very good reasons to lie. Nevertheless, he was convicted again and then denied on direct appeal. And because they weren't aware of many of the issues that we know about now, they had effectively just given up and submitted to life without the possibility of parole.
I've never been in a situation like the Holocaust or anything like that. But, you know, I mean, I just seen, you know, documentaries on that. And that's what it felt like, you know, when you're waiting to die. Stay here, get in that hole, and stay there until you die. You know what I mean? And it's inhumane. You know what I mean?
And eventually a series of Supreme Court decisions began to recognize that, at least for juveniles, first ruling in 2005 that the death penalty was a violation of the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment for juveniles, then the same for juvenile life without parole for non-homicide offenses in 2010, followed by an extension to homicide cases in 2012, and then those decisions were ruled retroactive in 2016. So Fred, who was only 16 when this crime occurred, found support from both Jeffrey Harris, who is private counsel, as well as Lisa Kavanaugh, the director of the Committee for Public Services Counsel Innocence Program, and they worked on his parole package, as well as a motion for a new trial based on actual innocence.
Lisa Kavanaugh and Jeff Harris took on Fred's case, and there was a different attorney appointed for James. They really dug down deep into it and found all the stuff on the third-party culprits of who probably did do the shooting, but has never been held accountable.
Now, there were police reports that implicated two young men from the projects, Tyrone and Junior Cooper, who were known to wear leather jackets. And Tyrone was short, matching the description. But more importantly, according to Diane Moses' initial interview, a man named Jimmy Poole had implicated the Cooper brothers as well. But it looks like since the police already had Dwyer identifying Fred and James, they were not interested in the Coopers. Nonetheless, trial counsel should have raised this material issue, and therefore they were ineffective.
They actually got Fred released in August of 2017. His motion for new trial was allowed, I think, a week before they were going to release him on parole. James did not get involved with that motion for new trial. I was not involved yet, so he stayed behind in prison. Then I took over his case in May of 2018. Really, credit to Lisa and Jeff because they did more than half of the work for me because they had already done Fred's case. And then we had the best investigator in the world, John Nardizzi.
And the investigator was able to get confirmation about Diane Moses and her motivation to bear false witness by speaking with her daughter, Sherelle Moses.
Yeah, Sherelle, how it came to me was her daughter asked, you know, like, Mom, did Jimmy do that? And she said, no. I told him that because they was going to take you away from me, take my kids from me. So she said it was either my kids or him. I gave him him.
And that's not all John Nardizzi uncovered.
When we did our investigation, we found a letter that the DA at the time, Tim O'Neill, had written to a hypnosis expert because he wanted to hire him to testify at the trial. And he laid out how it went. And what he said in the letter was that he was hypnotized and then he was shown photographs. But at trial, he kept presenting it as he made an identification free of hypnotism. Then he was hypnotized. Then he made a second identification, which is why in the second letter we found, the expert said, I can't really help you because it's not going to be admissible because it's tainted. So that was never turned over to the defense, even though the defense knew, both defense knew how the actual identification process went down, but they could never prove it. If they had this letter from the expert and the letter he wrote to the expert, it would have been very clear.
So this is the proof of the false narrative. And had they been able to prove it back at trial, Richard Dwyer's ID would not have been admitted. But the investigator uncovered still more, even more about Dwyer.
The cab company that he worked for was owned by an individual named James Quinn. He's a millionaire. And the cab drivers that were working for James Quinn were afraid that they wasn't getting protection from stuff like this. So him and James Quinn got together and cocked up the story. And I also forgot to tell you that when Berlow took me down to the station, right, that Monday night, the other guy that was with him, I found out, was the owner of the cab company, James Quinn. But when we went to trial, I seen him again. I said, damn, this motherfucker was in the car with me when I went down to the station.
So it appears that the police and Dwyer may have been acting at the behest of this wealthy cab company owner to close this case in order to reassure his workers so he could keep the money rolling in. Meanwhile, the Cooper brothers were free to commit similar crimes, including one confirmed armed robbery. So with the alternate suspect evidence, Sherelle Moses, the hypnotism correspondence, they were able to file a motion for a new trial based on ineffective assistance of counsel and prosecutorial misconduct.
We had the best co-counsel in the world, Madeline Blanchett, and Radha Natarajan from the New England Innocence Project helped us with the investigation. So we had a great team. Without John and Maddie and Radha and Lisa and Jeff, I don't know what would happen to James. And the reality is that once we found that evidence, COVID hit in March of 2020. So now we worked on the motion for a new trial. Maddie, my co-counsel, took over and did the motion to stay. And it was new territory to try to get somebody out convicted of first-degree murder, not once, but twice. But she wrote a brilliant motion to stay. And one of the reasons we were granted the stay was because the Commonwealth admitted that we had a colorable claim because of the withheld evidence between the expert and the DA. So they admitted there was a very real chance of winning on that issue. And the judge found it as well. So that gave us a lot of hope that it would have a good result in the end. And before I even filed my full motion for a new trial, we got him released in April 16th, 2020. He walked out the door.
James was on supervised release while the state conducted their own investigation. And finally, after more than 41 long years, James was reunited with his son, Don Juan Moses, who was just 13 months old when James was arrested.
He lives in Maine. He does hospice. He loves caring for the elderly. He's full of love. He's full of compassion. So he's just like his dad. I know he's mine. Always caring. And I got two grandchildren, Kimoni Jerome Moses and Olivia Rose Moses. It's amazing. You know me, I'm just, every time I open my eyes, I thank Barbara, John, every time I open my eyes, because I can open my eyes and actually look at the sky and not a cell. I can walk where I want to walk, say what I want to say, go where I want to go, no restraints. And I really didn't really appreciate freedom until I actually lost it. And now that I got it back, I appreciate it more than you can imagine.
And his release and eventually his claim of innocence got support from an unexpected source.
One of the main reasons he got out on the stay is because of the victim's family, the Boyajians. Jerry and Katrina wrote a letter to the district attorney and agreed that James should be released. And you don't see that often. They are extraordinary people.
Yes, they are.
But that time they didn't really have the full information. So I think it was probably in the back of their mind that, first of all, Fred was released. So they knew that one man had been wrongfully convicted. Now here comes the second man who was also wrongfully convicted. But they said because of his health issues and until this was decided, it was a humane thing to do. And there's not a lot of people that would say that. They, to this day now, do believe that he is innocent. And they have become quite close with James and Linda.
Linda is James's fiance.
Matter of fact, I talked to Jerry and Katrina yesterday. We want to drive out there and go out to dinner. I didn't meet them until it was at an innocent conference. And that's the first time I actually seen them in the flesh. It blew me away because they apologized to me what happened to me. I was like, you don't have to apologize to me. I'm so happy and so glad to meet you. And I'm so sorry for what happened to your brother. And we gave each other a hug. And, you know, and I told him that the government owes us an apology. They victimized us. Me, Freddie, you, your family, and your brother. They victimized us. They welcomed me into their home. And it was strange because I'm saying, here I am sitting in this man's home, the brother of the man that was murdered, and telling me that I believe you are innocent. I was speechless. Man. Jerry and Katrina is part of my family now. I mean, Barbara Monroe Angel is what I'm calling that. Yeah, we're family for life.
Well, that's beautiful. And there's still more good news after that.
I finished filing up the actual motion for new trial in June 2020. And then it was up to the Conviction Integrity Unit to do their investigation and whether they would assent to the motion, which took until November 10th. So now it was up to the judge to allow the motion. So we had assumed that James would have his day in court. We bought him a freedom suit, a nice custom tailor-made freedom suit for him to wear to court. And it was November 10th. And I was having my coffee and looking at the docket, and I see motion allowed. I was like, what? Nobody called us. Nobody told us. I read it on the docket. I was stunned. I mean, I was ecstatic, but I was stunned. So he never got to go to court. We didn't tell him. We arranged an impromptu celebration.
And they created some reason for him to try on the suit, that he needed to buy a new button-down shirt to go with the suit.
It was me, my son, and John, my investigator. And we was out looking for a shirt. We drove back to the house, and everybody was there. My family was there, Barbara, my nieces and nephews that weren't born when I went in. And had no nieces and nephews. It's like, welcome home. It was amazing.
And since he's been home, he's dedicated his time to building a nonprofit called Confronting Injustice.
Yes, me and my fiance, Linda Solomon, formed this organization called Confronting Injustice, supporting wrongfully convicted and others adversely impacted by the judicial system. We have a YouTube channel, and we do our podcasting here at the house, and we interview guys. And what we deal with is post-incarceration syndrome, people who are locked up, coming out of prison. Their mind has been reprogrammed, so to speak. You're being in prison 10, 15 years, being told when to eat, shit, and sleep for decades. That gets embedded in your mind. And you really stop believing you can't do nothing else but what somebody else tells you to do. People don't know how serious it is. It's really serious. I mean, then they come out here and try to function. But like my buddy Freddie, he went in as a baby. He was stopped at 16. So we work with guys and women. We go to court. We go and support them. We write letters to the parole board. And the guys that have come out, who come out, they don't have nothing. No ID. And you need a mass ID. When you get an apartment, a roof over your head, food to eat. So we support them.
If you want to check out the YouTube channel, it's hosted on YouTube for BCAM TV, a nonprofit media company out of Braintree, Massachusetts. We're going to have it linked in the episode description, along with the New England Innocence Project, a great organization. And getting involved with organizations like this one goes a long way to making sure innocent men like James, as well as innocent women across the country, have their freedom restored. And with that, we're going to go to closing arguments. This is where I thank you, Barb, and of course, James, from the bottom of my heart. And I'm now going to turn off my microphone, just close my eyes and listen to anything else you have to share. Barb, you go first and then just hand the mic off to James and he'll take us off into the sunset.
When these men, usually men, but women as well, come out of prison, sometimes, most of the time, they don't even get an apology, which they should. but they certainly don't get compensation. They walk out that door. I don't know what they get. What I think you got $50, James, and then they took some money out because you owed money on your canteen. And they're just left to their own to figure it out after they've been incarcerated. James was in almost 42 years. And thankfully, he had family there to help him, and he had us as well. But not everyone has that. And there's no compensation. They're trying to get compensation for people immediately when they get out. But even what they get now through the state, if you are, quote unquote, actually innocent, which nobody ever is, according to them, the most that somebody can get, the most that James could have gotten was $1 million for 42 years in prison. Figure out the math. That's abominable. And then if you decide to do a claim against the city, there's prosecutorial immunity, so that's a problem in itself. But then they're forced to go and wait to try to get compensation. The city of Boston has deep pockets. They can outwait somebody. James doesn't have time to wait for that money. So what does he have to end up doing at some point in time? Settle for less than he should be getting. And there's no amount of money that can compensate for what he's lost, but there should be a much higher amount of money that they should get, because society needs to correct this, and these are not disposable people.
I've got tremendous support that we got confronting the justice. We talk to the men on the telephone. Sometimes we invite them to the house. We sit down, we eat, and help them get through whatever that's bothering them at this particular time. You know what I mean? Because there's so much you can do at the immediate, because I don't want to see nobody go through what I went through. And I know when I lay my head down tonight, somebody's being wrongfully convicted or even murdered, man, by our beloved government. Man, don't be afraid to speak up. Somebody will believe you. Thanks to Barbara, Maddie, I'm living proof. Somebody will listen to you. You can write me. They got an address they can write, and I definitely will return your letter. I'm going to do everything in my power before I leave this planet. Hopefully, something changes. The law changes. Something changes. Because, you know, if they did that to one of my family members, I would lose my shit.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Clyburn. The music in this production was supplied by three-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.
We have worked hard to ensure that all facts reported in this show are accurate. The views and opinions expressed by the individuals featured in this show are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Lava for Good.
Hey, Brooklyn Nine-Niners, it's a reunion. The ladies of the Nine-Nine are getting back together for a special episode of the podcast, More Better. Hosts Stephanie Beatriz and Melissa Fumero welcome friend and former castmate Chelsea Peretti.
Remember when we were in that scene where you guys were just supposed to hug and I was standing there?
Oh, yeah.
I was like, can I also hug them?
Listen to More Better with Stephanie and Melissa on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Follow More Better and start listening on the free iHeart Radio app today.
Black History Month is here, and we're excited to kick off season 4 of I Didn't Know, Maybe You Didn't Either. This season, we're shining a spotlight on revolutionary women who redefined excellence. Give Grace Wisher her flowers. Next time you see the American flag, you just remember a 16-year-old black woman helped to make it happen. Listen to I Didn't Know, Maybe You Didn't Either from the Black Effect Podcast Network on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or simply wherever you get your podcasts.
What if you asked two different people the same set of questions? Even if the questions are the same, our experiences can lead us to drastically different answers. I'm Minnie Driver, and I set out to explore this idea in my podcast, and now Minnie Questions is returning for another season. We've asked an entirely new set of guests our 7 questions, including Jane Lynch, Delaney Rowe, and Cord Jefferson. Listen to Minnie Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.